Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here on this Wednesday, January the 18th, 2017, 1:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have got a great hour of programming for you this hour. Don't want you to go anywhere. The last 15 minutes today, 1:45 p.m., we're going to be joined from the East Room of the White House right before President Obama's last press conference by former panelist on the McLaughlin Group and current reporter for the Daily Beast, Eleanor Clift. So Eleanor Clift, 1:45 today, will be live sitting in the East Room 1.5 hours before President Obama's last press conference. She'll be speaking to us live on a cell phone today, 1:45, in about a half hour. So don't go anywhere. Our first guest today is one of my favorite people. He was on this program about 2 weeks ago, and unfortunately, midway through our interview, we had some phone trouble. But we were able to work that out, hopefully, and he has very kindly spared another half hour for us today to finish up that interview. He is a television icon, and you cannot say that about everybody. He came into your homes for more than a half century, 35 of those years, on the very popular game show The Price is Right, right up until 2007. He is, if you're 90 or you are 10, you know this man's name, the legendary American treasure, Bob Barker. Mr. Barker, how are you?
Well, after that introduction, I'm splendid.
You know, Bob, it's very interesting. Sometimes you have guests on the show, and they're stuck in an age group. If I ask a 10-year-old or a 100-year-old, everybody knows Bob Barker. You have mass appeal.
Well... Thank you very much. You have certainly started my day off well.
Bob, what are your days like in your ninth decade? What do you do?
Well, I am a complete success at retirement. I do just as I wish. I do a lot of work on behalf of animals, as you know. That takes a lot of my time, and it's time not only well spent, but time that I thoroughly enjoy. And beyond that, I read quite a bit, and I still work out. I'm not certainly like I once did, but I try to work out. I think exercise and diet are very important when you're 93 years old.
You worked regular days up until your eighth decade. You were in your 80s when you retired.
I did, at 83.
Did you ever think of leaving earlier than that at what is conventionally a retirement age, or were you just having too much fun?
No, I didn't consider retirement. Unlike someone who's doing something that they don't thoroughly enjoy, my work was, I didn't even think of it as work. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was blessed in that I was able to earn a living doing something that I enjoyed. Some people get up in the morning and think, oh, I don't want to go to work. I don't want to go to the office. I don't want to do this. I never did that. I always got up feeling just great about going over to the studio because I had just as much fun there as anybody in the audience.
That being said, you now have been retired this year, this May. You'll have been retired 10 years. Do you ever, you're a complete success at retirement, but
that's right.
Do you ever get the urge to go back and do something?
No, I don't really. I was back on the show as a guest. Actually, it was April Fool's Day. I was the Price is Right April Fool, and I was behind the doors where Drew Carey makes his in, and they said, "Now here's the star of our show," and They opened the doors, and there I was, not Drew. And they just applauded wildly. And I came out and talked about being selected, very carefully selected as a fool, and actually started the show. Got the contestants down, contestants row, did the bidding, and got one of them up on stage and played the pricing game. And it just all went very well, and it was fun. And I then I said goodbye, and Drew came on and did the show. And backstage, several people said, "Barker, you could do the show right now. You did that just fine. You could do the show." And I told them, I said, "I did one game. That's not an hour. And I'm just too old to face that."
So at this point, you think to go back and do something like that may not be the best idea?
To go back and try to do the show again?
It would just maybe do a special hour. Do the whole hour.
Or that's tough. That price is right. Unlike so many shows, the host is not just sitting there and talking with people, or he's moving around. He's all over the stage, and you have to keep the audience up. At least I did during commercials. I never left the stage. Now some of the hosts do leave the stage, and the announcer takes over during commercials. I didn't do that. I stayed out there, and it was a show for the whole hour, because I tried to keep the audience up. You get them up, and you don't want to try to start them over every time after every commercial, and at least I didn't. And it is physically, as well as mentally, a pretty long hour.
Do you watch The Price is Right?
Did I what?
Do you watch The Price is Right?
No, I don't watch it. I check it occasionally, but I don't watch it daily, no.
Were you happy with Drew Carey?
Yes. Drew is a very nice fellow. And when I was leaving the show, you know, I closed every show with my plug, help control the pet population, have your pet spayed or neutered. And I was hopeful that whoever took over would continue that. And when Drew was chosen, and the first meeting, I was going to suggest to him that he continue my plug. And before I could say, "How do you do?" he said, "Bob, I want you to know that every day, as long as I do the show, I'll do your spay-neuter plug." And I kissed him on the lips.
You know, Bob, I was thinking, when you left that show in 2007, 35 years, you were so synonymous with that show. Did you have any fear that it might have gone away? Sometimes when there's a host change, it doesn't go over well.
Well, I certainly hoped that it wouldn't go away, because I was going to get well paid, not as well as if I had done the show, but I had a deal where I had a royalty for a certain amount of time, and it's just about to play out now, so I may have to look for a job. But I hoped it would go on, and it has, and it's going along strongly.
Did you ever consider, when The Price is Right was over, doing something else?
No. If I had any interest in doing something else, I would have never left The Price is Right, because I was doing the show as well as I'd ever done it, and I didn't want to, but it was becoming more and more tiring to do the show, and I didn't want to stay on and have it start going downhill and having people saying, "Barker's just too old, he ought to get off there," and that sort of thing. I wanted to stop while I was at the top of my game, and that's just what I did.
You know, I think there were only two other people who really had runs like yours in television, one, of course, being Johnny Carson, 30 years at The Tonight Show, and David Letterman had about 34 years in late night. We never saw Carson again. never did anything else. David Letterman is now doing documentaries for the National Geographic channel, I think. Are you more toward the Johnny Carson or more toward the David Letterman?
Definitely toward the Johnny Carson. I have had people suggest that maybe I'd like to do a show, and that they were selling or whatever. And I said, no, no, no. If I were going to work, I would never have left Price is Right.
You know, Saturday night, I was watching, and normally I don't watch network television. ABC is now doing these revivals of Match Game and To Tell the Truth and Pyramid. Do you think that's a good idea, to bring the game shows back?
Well, why not? You know, these networks and these stations are interested in ratings, and if a show can was made 20, 30 years ago and it still will bring in viewers, and they'll sell commercials, and that's what it's all about.
Would you ever like to, not host, but go back and maybe be a panelist on Match Game or To Tell the Truth?
No, I don't. I'm not interested in doing anything regularly.
Nothing at all.
I do guest things, just like I'm doing with you right now.
Bye.
And I do them on television as well as radio. But I don't want to do it daily, no.
What was the interest in animals? Where did that start?
Well, like millions of people all over the country, all over the world, I was born with the love of animals. Among my earliest memories are animals. And I consider it a blessing because I have nothing but sympathy for people who don't love animals because they're missing so much of life. But I loved animals of all kinds from the day I can remember. And I helped them when I was just a kid. I used to pick up strays, and if they were hurt or something, I tried to help them. And I've worked with them all my life, and I think it is truly a blessing to love animals.
Do you think it extends your life after, unfortunately, you lose a loved one, your spouse, possibly for people?
Well, I think everything that you enjoy, everything that really grabs your interest and your attention, I think that is a part of the things that keep you alive. And in my case, I know that animals have made me happy when I had reason not to be happy, and have made me enjoy being with them, and they just are a big part of my life.
Bob, when I look at a lot of the game shows now, they seem to be hosted by comedians. You were a broadcaster, and back in those days, Gene Rayburn, people of that nature, they were broadcasters. What makes a good game show host?
Well, I really, after having done these shows for all these years, a half a century, you'd think I know, but I really don't. I didn't even know that I could be a game show host. I had no interest in acting or being on radio or being in the movies or something like that. None. I was never in a school play. I was never a debater, and I never was before an audience at all. And I got into radio quite by accident. During World War II, I was a naval aviator. And when I got out of the Navy and went back to school, I was married. When I got my wings, I got married. It was almost a part of the ceremony. Everybody got married. And I got married. So when I went back to school, I wanted to have a part-time job. And I don't even remember how I heard about it, but I heard about the manager of a radio station who was crazy about airplanes. He had his own little plane. And it occurred to me that if he was crazy about airplanes, he might like to have a former fighter pilot work for him. So I put on my naval officer's uniform. I could still get in it then. And put my wings of gold on my chest, and I went in and met Mr. G. Pearson Ward. And he and I talked for about 45 minutes about airplanes, and I had my first job in radio. And in those days, probably still the same, in a small station, you had a chance to do everything. And I did. I did sports. I did. I wrote local news. I did newscasts. And eventually I was a staff announcer and everything. And one day during my shift as a staff announcer, the host of an audience participation show that we did there in the studio didn't show up. Now, this was when everything was live. If you didn't have the host there, you had dead air. And Mr. Ward came rushing into the booth to me. He said, "Bob, you've got to get in there and do that show." Well, I knew the show because it was on my shift, but I'd certainly never thought about doing it. But I jumped up, didn't have a chance to get nervous, got rushing in there, grabbed the microphone, and I was on the air. And I went out in the audience, and I said something to this lady, and she replied. And then I said something, and the audience burst into laughter. And I'll never forget. It startled me. I kind of jumped. And I thought, oh, my, I like that sound. And I'm going to try to make them do that some more. And I did. And fortunately, when I got home, my wife, Dorothy Jo, had heard that show. And she said, "Barker, that's what you should do." She said, "You did that better than you've ever done anything else." And so she and I set out from that day on to get me a national radio show. But and then television came along and made it to get a television show, and we did it. And I thank the good Lord for it.
How integral to your life was your wife, your marriage?
Oh, she was everything. She was my sweetheart from the day I met her. We met in high school. We had our first date November 17th, 1939. And she went home that day, that night. She told me later, she went home that night and she said, "I've just met the man I'm going to marry." And she sure did. We were together from then on. We were in high school together and college together. And when I got my wings as a naval aviator, we got married, and we were married until forever.
She's been gone a few years now. How hard was that? How did you get past that?
Well, I'm not past it. I still miss her. I have pictures of her all over the house. I'm looking right now at a picture of she and I on the stairs here at home. And I'll never stop missing her. I don't think I would have been in radio and television if I hadn't been for her. And she worked right beside me. When we came to California, she produced my shows and edited them and helped me write them, and we were side by side.
For somebody who might be going through that, how do you cope? How have you had a good life since she left? One of the things, I guess, is what I'm saying, living to 93, one of the unfortunalities is you lose a lot of people. What's the best way to deal with that?
Well, we all have to go, and you just have to face the fact that you've lost a friend or a relative or a wife, and go on and try to do with your life what is most satisfactory to you. I've never stopped missing Dorothy Jo. I go out to the cemetery regularly and talk with her just as if she were there. And think about her when I think that I think she would have enjoyed or been a part of and helped me make a success of it. I pray regularly that I'll be with her someday.
Somebody this morning, it's interesting, I hadn't thought about this name for a long time, but somebody this morning mentioned the name Rod Roddy. What was he like?
Well, Rod was, he was a lot of fun. And he had a wardrobe like none other that I've ever known of. Those wild, wild jackets. And I don't think he'd ever done a national show before Price, but he might have. I don't believe he did, though. But he had a vast experience in stations all over the country, I think. And he was a very nice guy. He was funny. He was very bright. And it was very unfortunate that he departed as early as he did in life, because he certainly enjoyed life.
On The Price is Right, The Price is Right was unique in the fact that it was the host, you had the announcer, and then you had the Barker's Beauties. Was there anybody on that staff on camera that you looked at as like, that was your, you had just tremendous chemistry with that person on air, that it just worked well?
Well, the people with whom I had the most contact with or talked with most or were the most part of the show when we were actually doing it was the announcer. And I never had only had one or two. But starting with Johnny Olson. Johnny Olson, the show was a Mark Goodson production, and the Goodson Company had about three shows on the air most of the time. Many of these shows over the years had announcers. But everybody always wanted Johnny Olson, because he was just a splendid announcer and a fun fellow to talk with on the air. And we were lucky enough to get him the day, first day of the show, and we had him on our show until he died. But I was blessed with Johnny Olson. He was the man.
So many people remember you from Happy Gilmore. How did that role come about?
Remember me for what?
Happy Gilmore with Adam Sandler.
Oh. Oh, I know they do, because they still mention it to me. I got a call from the company, and they wanted me to do this show and this movie, and they said that they wanted me to play the role that I did play, and I said, well, it sounds like fun. I said, sure, I'll do it, so I did. And I went up to Canada. My part in it was shot in Canada on that golf course. And the night I arrived, and that night, the director of the show came to my hotel and talked about what we were going to do, and he said, now don't worry about the fight scene. He said, I have a double for that. You don't have to do that. I said, what do you mean? I said, that's what I want to do. I came up here for that fight scene. I've been studying karate with Chuck Norris, and I'm ready, man. And he said, all right. And that's what we did, and I beat up Adam Sandler pretty good, as you know. And after that movie had played, it came on fairly, they got released fairly soon. I never did a Price is Right that the audience didn't want to talk about that fight. particularly young men, and they'd say, could you really whip Adam Sandler? Could you really beat him up? I said, are you kidding? Adam Sandler couldn't whip Regis Philbin.
You know, Bob, one of the great things about that movie is it played on this idea of you golfing, which people had associated you with. How good was and is your golf game?
I don't play anymore. I have had a little trouble with my back, and I can't pivot. My golf game, the only word that would really cover it was unpredictable. But a lot of people, in fact, most, amateurs and even the professionals, it's unpredictable. Golf is a tough game. It really is. Even the professionals have bad days with golf.
Want to just, in the last few minutes we have here, talk about a few more things that are associated with Bob Barker. The hair.
Hair?
The hair.
Uh-huh.
Going,
the color.
Yeah, the hair color. Why did you ever expect that to get that much attention?
No. I had no idea that it would get that kind of attention. My hair had become gray, and like everybody else in television, I started tinting it. And it got to be a real drag. I was going all over the country then, or world, doing Miss Universe and Miss USA, big nighttime specials. And you had to get somebody to take care of your hair and so on. I thought, I'm had it. So I decided, I was on vacation, and I decided I'm going to let my hair go gray. And I told somebody that. I don't know who it was associated with the show. In any event, they found out about it at CBS, and they insisted that I come in with my hair not tinted and let them see me on camera before we did it. And so I did, and without exception, they said that's fine. They said, looks good. We'll go for it. So I let it go. I came out there with the gray hair, and you could practically hear the gasp from the audience. I got a letter from one guy. He said, Bob, you must have had one hell of a night. But it worked out fine, and I felt better about it. It wasn't as much trouble, and a lot of people said they thought I looked better, and I might add that there were other hosts who started going gray, too.
Well, it's interesting, because after it went gray, then the thing was, boy, does Bob Barker have a nice head of hair. And it still holds up.
Well, most of it's still there, but there's a little less than there once was.
Bob, I want you to tell the story really quick about why you stopped doing the Miss USA pageant.
Oh, well, I can make that just very, very short. They gave away a fur coat on the show, and I didn't like it. I asked them to stop. We did it on Price is Right, as a matter of fact. When I first started, we gave away fur coats, and I asked them to stop, and they did. But unfortunately, the beauty pageants wouldn't stop, and I did them for years there. But we were always going to stop, and the next year we'd stop, and then they just didn't do it, and I quit. I resigned.
Is there anything you still want to do in life?
Is there what?
Is there anything left you still want to accomplish?
You mean professionally?
Professionally, personally, anything. At 93, anything you still want to do?
No, I've done a lot of things that I've thoroughly enjoyed, and I certainly have had wonderful opportunities on television and doing things that I enjoyed. And I'm just kind of riding with the storm here, I don't have any ambitions that I'm gonna. Oh boy, what I want to do is, I just wait and things happen, and I do them if I want to, and I don't. That's what's wonderful about being retired. I have no real obligations.
Bob, when we started this interview, I started by saying that if you're 10 years old or 100 years old, you know who Bob Barker is.
Well, with your help, I'm going to keep that going.
You are. And my question is, do you, it may seem like a silly question, but do you know that you're Bob Barker, this icon in television that everybody loves?
Well, I know I'm Bob Barker. I do know that. As far as being an icon, that sounds like a pretty big deal, and I'm not sure I'm that, but I love to have people say I am. And I enjoy being well known. I enjoy having people at a restaurant wave to me or something like that. I think that's a compliment. And I live in a neighborhood where these buses go by, you know, and tourist buses. And sometimes they catch me when I'm out in front of the house or something like that. And unlike some people, they kind of try to ignore them. I love it. The bus even stops and I'll talk with the people. Those people in these buses, when they go by here, I just remember that without those people, I would have had to work for a living.
Mm. That's nicely put. Bob, 100 years from now, because you have become this mainstay in television, when people look back at the tapes, when people watch you on the internet, or however they'll be doing it 100 years from now, how do you hope they look back on Bob Barker?
I hope they just kind of think he's an okay guy.
Is there anything we don't know about Bob Barker?
There are a few things, and we're not going to talk about them.
You gave me time for that last question with the short answer, Bob.
Well, that's the answer.
Bob, you really are. There are a lot of people who we are lucky enough to get on this show, but there are few treasures. Everybody knows Bob Barker, and when we say Bob is coming on, everybody loves it. Republican, Democrat, whatever race, color, or creed, Bob Barker has changed the world, and it's an honor to have you on, and I hope you do come back again.
Well, with your attitude and your complimentary remarks, I'll come back anytime you want.
Bob, you stay well, and we will talk again in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bob Barker. No, it doesn't get any better than that. We're going to go to the East Room in the White House after this very short but important break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, right here on WWGH Radio from 12:10 to 2 p.m. Listen to the program for guests like these. The voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid and actress Pat Carroll.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actress to play. They have more edges to them. They have more color to them. Isn't that a shame that goodness isn't more fascinating, or our world would be better?
I guess.
But there is something fascinated about tacky people, mean people. They're colorful. Good people always seem to be a little bit, ugh, yucky. But bad people always have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors. Because you can pick all the things in life as a human being that annoy you or that you would like to do to be really rotten mean. Most people are too afraid to be rotten mean because we want people's approval so badly. And we know that being rotten mean isn't going to get us that. But, oh, villains for actors are the best things in the world to play.
You know, Pat, that almost describes our current political situation in this country.
Doesn't it just? I never thought of that, but you're quite right.
Join me Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. We'll take your calls, 740-383-9944, streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you here, 48 minutes past the hour, and in about 27 minutes, President Barack Obama will be giving his last press conference as President of the United States. So very quickly, we are going to go in these last 13 minutes to the East Room of the White House and talk with our good friend, former panelist on the McLaughlin Group, current reporter for the Daily Beast, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
Hi, I wish it were the East Room of the White House, which is spacious and has room for everybody. Instead, it's in the Brady Briefing Room, which is quite small, and people are piled on top of each other. The last time the president had a press conference in this room right before he left for the holidays, one woman fainted. It gets so hot and crowded. So I didn't even try to make my way toward my assigned seat. Because it's impossible to get through. So anyway, just to give you a sense of the mood here, well, a lot of interest in this president's last words, and he's done some interesting policy moves here in these last days as well. Lots to talk about.
What do you think the tenor of this press conference will be about?
Well, I think first the news of the day, the Chelsea Manning commutation and the other pardons that he has issued, along with more expected. And then I think it will be reflective as to what he is leaving behind and what he anticipates. And I'm sure he will reiterate how he is committed to a smooth transition. And I think he'll be pressed on likely Supreme Court fights. I think his press secretary has said that the Republicans' refusal to give Merrick Garland, Mr. Obama's choice, a hearing or a vote, leaves a scar on the institution of the U.S. Senate. And I think there will be an effort to prod out of President Obama exactly what he's going to be doing in the next months of this administration. I think his answer will be sleep and stay out of it, at least for a while.
The Chelsea Manning pardon was heavily criticized last night by Republicans and a lot of people in the media. Do you think this is going to be hard for him to explain today?
No, I think it's quite easy to explain when you cite the fact that Manning got 35 years, which is longer than anyone accused of a similar crime, that she accepted the guilt for what she did, stood the punishment, and that she has served some 7 years, much of it in solitary confinement under terribly abusive conditions. And she's now in Leavenworth, which is an all-male facility, and she is a transgender female. So, you know, I think that the opposition from the Republicans is mostly reflexive and also doesn't take into account the incoming president's views on some of these issues. He's kind of been all over the lot, and he has been noticeably quiet on the commutation of Chelsea Manning when he tweets about just everything else. It's interesting that I don't believe that he has said anything about this.
This is the last press conference of a president who people thought was a great orator. It is historic, first African-American president. Is there a sadness there? Is it different when it's the last press conference?
I think there's such an effort on the part of the president and the people around him to leave on a high note so that they can do what they can to put his legacy in a positive light, because many people interpret the fact that his chosen successor did not win as a reflection on President Obama. And I think the characteristics that you noted, that he's a great orator and he's a pioneer, I think they feel sometimes overshadows the real substantive hard work that he did in the job and his real accomplishments. And I do think in the press corps itself, there is apprehension about what the new president will mean for people who actually work in this building and who cover the president day to day. They're looking at someone who might not even be in the White House all that much, someone who, as at least his aides have talked about, moving the press out of these very cramped quarters in the White House, and someone who has a very contentious relationship with the media. Not that President Obama was anybody's best friend. There were tense moments here over the last 8 years as well, but there was mutual respect for the work that, that each side did. And I'm not sure that exists in the next administration.
That being said, you talked about how somebody had fainted in that room. We do know Donald Trump's relationship with the press, the Esquire story this past weekend about moving the press out of the White House. Is there a happy medium? Can you stay in the White House, go to a different room? What's the best idea here with Trump coming in?
Well, when you look at the mob scene here in the press room, and that's probably going to be what it's like, at least in the early weeks and months of the Trump administration. Interest gradually wanes, but there is a case to be made to be holding these kind of events in what's called the South Court Auditorium, which is just across the driveway. It's part of the White House compound. It's in the old executive office building, and it's a big, roomy auditorium. Everybody would have a seat. Many more people could get in, and I think Sean Spicer, the incoming communications person and press secretary, has expressed interest in doing that. He got a lot of blowback from reporters who just feel that any suggestion that they might be moved out of the White House has to be resisted. And, you know, I've covered a number of administrations, and when the Clinton people came to town, George Stephanopoulos, who was the original press person or communications person, closed off these two little steps that led to his office. And there was such an outcry that they quickly reversed it. And that corridor leading to the press secretary's office remains open. And it's only 50 feet from the Oval Office, but you know, it's not as though you're observing the president at work. There are Secret Service agents in between. But it's highly symbolic, the ability of the press to remain in this building. And they could, you know, they could continue to let people work in here on a day-to-day basis. But when they have the big events, then move them to the auditorium. And but people see that as the first step to moving the entire press corps into the old EOB. And that's like Siberia. So even though it's symbolic, it's not like you have any greater access here. You're in the White House. It just means an awful lot over these many decades and presidents of different parties.
If you could ask President Barack Obama one question today, 48 hours before he leaves the White House, what would it be?
Gosh, I'd like to know how he maintains his consistent optimistic attitude, and the fact that he has taken so much incoming, and some of it, you know, questioning his birth credentials, his, you know, I think some of it is a backlash to his race, you know, how he manages to put that in a perspective that he is able to be so even day to day. Well, it's rare that we see a burst of emotion one way or the other from this president, either, you know, anger or sorrow. Those moments have been there, but he's really a very cool customer.
With about 3 minutes left here, do you think Tillerson will get confirmed? And what did you make of the education secretary hearing yesterday, Senator Franken, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, very tough questions.
I think in the end, Tillerson, if the Republicans stick with him, and he may even get a couple of Democrats, I think he goes through. I thought some of the questioning by Senator Rubio and others sounded tough for the cameras, but I suspect in the end they're going to support him. I was kind of amazed at the negativity towards the incoming education secretary. You know, that's normally a pretty easy confirmation. But, you know, her background, you know, the millions that her family has given to Republican candidates, the fact that she's, you know, never attended a public school, I don't think, who knows if she's ever been in one, and her antipathy towards public education and her inclination to privatize everything, I think really offends every one of the Democrats. I don't see her getting a single Democratic vote. But again, if the Republicans stick together, she gets in. But she has a lot of negatives, I think, in how she came across as really a privileged person who really cares more about for-profit schooling than she does about public education for the vast numbers of children who attend those schools. She seems to think that for-profit education is the wave of the future, and she doesn't seem to give any respect towards public schooling, which has launched so many people. It's always a great melting pot of this nation, and it works very well in most places. In some cities, inner cities, it doesn't, and that's where the focus should be.
With 60 seconds left, Eleanor, how does Friday go? Two polar opposites, one leaving, one coming, with Donald Trump, Obama leaving, Congress people sitting home, 800,000 expect to attend, apparently a million protesting at home and in different states. What's Friday look like?
You know, I think President Obama will make us proud, and I even think that Donald Trump in his inauguration address will say the right things. Presumably, he won't go off script. He won't go wandering and taking on, you know, personal fights. I think he'll do well, but I do think there's going to be a lot of protesting that will mar the day. A lot of Democrats are not attending, and those tickets float around. I think there'll probably be some protesters in the immediate audience. I hope everything is nonviolent and upholds the tradition of peaceful protest. And then I think Saturday, I think the numbers that show up on Saturday should be a wake-up call to Mr. Trump that he really has a lot of ground to make up. Public opinion is an important part of the ability to govern, and the ground that he's lost since the election during what should be a relatively peaceful time, the transition, should make him realize how self-destructive he can be. And once he gets the real tools of power, I think we can all only hope that he handles them well.
President Obama's last press conference coming up in 15 minutes on all the cable channels, and I'm sure the networks, wherever you are, 2:15 p.m. Eastern Time. Eleanor Clift, live from the Brady Briefing Room at the Daily Beast. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. And that's all the time we have. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
I'm glad it happened. I feel blessed.
Do you ever think of an epitaph?